Okay, here's where I'm at now. It's just, this thought just always came through. You know, I always do this. I always go. Don't take my glasses off. I've seen it on TV too many times. That's the kind of person I look for. That's the kind of person I look to always wanted to be. Not always, but, you know, the slick kind of cool dude. I didn't want to be the Lawrence Hilton Jacobs type cat in Welcome Back, Carter. I didn't want to be Rollo. I don't want to say I wanted to be Meathead, but the fact he was the atheist really intrigued me. I've always wanted to be smart and to be seen as smart. That's for sure. Funny and playful, silly, yes, but always smart. In fact, one of the most things that would trigger me or really offend me if somebody was calling me dumb, call me dumb or a liar, it triggers me. Here, you know, I just... And more than one time, I've retaliated with overwhelming strength, with overwhelming power when I may or may not should have. But anyway, I was thinking this whole self thing, and when I met Ayn Rand, or when I was introduced to her philosophy, and I was watching her interviews, she did a interview with Mike Douglas or Phil Donahue, one of them. She basically just flat out said, altruism is evil. Altruism is evil. I mean, she just, hold on, I gotta get some. Don't know if y'all can see that or not, but I had to get that out of my teeth. She basically said, how come it's not changing? She basically said, altruism is evil. Literally, that's what it was. Now, I won't go that far. She said, you know, altruism and self-sacrifice is the evil. That's what's ruining humanity, because that's what's ruining humanity. Now, if you take that, and I expounded on that in a thought I just had, it's easy. If what you want is made central in your life, if your desires and what you want, if you put that on the highest pedestal, and that's your number one goal, that almost gives you responsibility to achieve that. It's a lot easier just to say, oh, well, you know, I don't really want to do that, or I really don't want to do that because of someone else, or on the behalf of someone else, or because I got this obligation, or I got that obligation. Or in society, in my mind, society, family, nationalism, everything kind of pushes you to not being so into yourself, everything for your brother, your religion pushes you to that, you know, my brother's keeper. Nationalism, and not so much of socialism or communism, not even to that degree, but somewhere along the lines, everything is for the, you know, for someone else. And if you were to take the idea of what you want and put that first, that almost gives you a responsibility to achieve that. And it's hard. It's hard to achieve that. It's very hard. And one of the hard things about it is that you have to fight for it. And it's not about achieving a lot of times. It's not about achieving. A lot of times it's really just not about achieving. It's about fighting for it. Fighting to let your family that you do that. There are pressures from your family. There are just pressures from society, your friends, people around you to almost keep you in a box, because that's where they're comfortable with you at. That's where we're comfortable here. You just stay here and, you know, you be here and we're all cool and let's all conform and get along that way. I never had that. I knew from an early age I was gone from Youngstown. I knew at an early age I wanted more and I needed to get out of there. And I think just in the way I walked and talked, everybody kind of knew. And I don't think I said it until I started really getting into high school, towards the end of high school, and after DeVry and stuff, when it was obvious I needed to get out of there. You know, where I actually started articulating it. And I remember literally drawing L.A. Lakers and palm trees and L.A., the L.A. Initials. You know, I had colored pencils or whatever. And I can remember actually doing that. Because I was, you know, looking forward to it, apprehensive, but I knew the move was coming. You know, I knew I'm getting ready to leave this place and go to LA, go to California. And think about it. I got on the bus and went to California to live. Think about it. Think about that. I got on the bus. I was 22 years old. Got on the bus. Left Youngstown, Ohio to go live in Los Angeles. I had grown up in Youngstown, and I didn't know how small Youngstown was. I really didn't know how small Youngstown was. I told the story before. I didn't know how small Youngstown was, but I saw how big Akron was. Akron had skyscrapers and everything. Youngstown ain't got that. You know, of course, I saw Columbus, Ohio, and I saw Cleveland. You know, that I understood as being, you know. But until I saw Akron and saw what Akron had and Youngstown didn't, I was like, ooh, okay. So I went to Columbus, and I was able to navigate Columbus, learn how to use bus lines. I wasn't, you know, I'd run around the city by myself. I was taking job interviews. I was getting around. I had a car at first, and I lost the car because I was, you know, too many speeding tickets, and I let things get out of hand. And I started getting around on the bus, and, you know, I was able to hit interviews and navigate the city, a big city compared to, you know, Youngstown. And then I came back to Youngstown, and I was hanging there for like a few months. And then, you know, next thing you know, I'm in like L.A. I came out here to L.A. That was 40 years ago. That was 40 years ago this year, 1983. And I got to L.A., and you know, I had cousins here. I had family here. My cousin Debbie was here. I grew up with her. She brought me and her about the same age. She was here. She had already established. You know, people showed me. I had support. I had tremendous support. You know, and I had an electronic technician's diploma. I learned how to navigate, how to get around. But she got me a car. I got a car. I got my driver's license. You know, I went through the paces, you know, And I think I got out there in August. I think this is how it went. I don't know how long. I don't know. I think I was in there in August. I don't know if it was a year or the same year, but over the holidays, I moved in with Tony and Lynette, and Debbie moved in with Danny in Montana. And then Tony came to me and said, hey, man, you know, you got to start paying rent. I was like, you know, that's fair. Cause I was working. I was working at the Kennedy Company, I think. Yeah, I was working at Kennedy Company. You know, and so I was making, as an electronic technician, I think I was making $7.50 an hour. For me, that was a lot. So, you know, he came to me and said, yeah, you know, it's time for you to, you know, start paying rent. And I was like, okay. You know, and I had no problem with that because, you know, I was just grateful to sleep in there. You know, the garages out here were like modeled like living rooms. They had carpet and furniture in it, even though it was like a garage, you know, that wasn't used for cars. And so I was just grateful. And I was like, you know, that's fair. And then I think a couple weeks later, I found an apartment, you know, so, and I kind of still look back at that to this day that I never paid them rent. I still look back onto that day that I stayed with these people and never paid rent. When it came down to me paying rent, I found my home. And it wasn't intentional. It may have been intentional, maybe just the way I'm wired. Maybe it could be, it could literally be the way I'm wired. It's something like that is going to trigger me into, you know, doing what I need to do to get out of this situation. Maybe I don't, it wasn't nothing like in my mind, oh my God, I got it. I ain't paying them. You know, it wasn't like, I ain't going to pay them. Ooh, this is kind of hot. Let me turn that down. Did I switch mics or something? You know, it was like, I ain't gonna pay them. They ain't getting none of my money. No, it wasn't like that. It just so happens that maybe that little bit of rent paying emphasis was just enough to make me go, okay. And I found an apartment anyway. You know, and the rest is history. You know, rest is history. I mean, I just kind of got caught up in the fact that I left. You know, did I take a break yet today? No, I didn't. Okay, I gotta take a break. That I, you know, came out to big California, L.A. I wasn't scared. I wasn't scared. I was probably more scared of failing. You know, I wasn't scared of, you know, what was out here or not out here, what's going to get me. I was confident in myself. I knew, you know, I wanted to be in the big game. I wanted to see if I could compete, if I could, you know, mix it up with them. But, okay, where did I leave off at? Probably in the idea of once you place your what you want, what you believe, what you desire up front, it puts a responsibility on you to achieve those things. You can no longer say, oh, I didn't do that because of this. I didn't do that because of that. I didn't, you know, I didn't want to pursue this because of this or that. But once you, you know, okay, I got distracted. I'm doing two things. I'm doing two things at once. So, but once you, you know, actually place that and you put it in your mind that that's your goal, and I'm looking back on my life. I'm just saying, I'm looking back on my life and I'm thinking, I ain't never had that problem. I ain't never had that. Well, I ain't going to do this because of someone or something else. I've never had that problem. I don't know why. It could be the way I was raised. Could be the way I was taught, but I never had that problem. I don't ever remember me thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't do this. Other than when I was married. Other than when I was married and or in a relationship. And even then, it was evident that what the priority was in my life. Even when I was married, even though it may not have been stated, I've been told that it was evident what the priority was in my life. I don't know any other way. I don't know any other way than to be aggressive towards my passions, to pursue my passions. I mean, what else is there? I can't almost understand. To me, it's almost even hard to understand to pursue something outside of my passions. Is that even possible? Is it even possible to pursue something that is outside of your passion? I mean, because even if, it's not, because the only thing you're going to do is the stuff you like to do. Even if, like I said, a thousand times before, if what you do is want to help the world and save the whales, and that may seem benevolent, that's still just what you want to do. And I come back to this again, and I come back to this again. What one wants for themselves. What you want for yourself. I cannot see how that cannot be the number one priority in anyone's life. I don't understand it. I don't understand it. But then, as I said before, forgot where I left off again, but I think I'm rambling, in a way that I'm getting down the thoughts that are coming out of my head. You can say I'm brainstorming, you know, I'm streaming consciousness, I'm spitballing, whatever, but I'm getting it all out. You know, I'm getting it all out of my mind, out of my head, and I'm getting down in digital. And that's the first part of it. You know, getting it down in digital is the first part of it. And then I can expound on it later, you know. And that's the whole idea of it all. I got distracted. See, when I get distracted, I get distracted. My job comes first. See, I got priorities. Even though I'm doing what I want to do, even though, like, okay, here's this may be a good example. My priority is my job. So what I want to do is something outside of something for myself or outside. Well, actually, I'm still doing it for myself, but something outside of something for me. No, it's actually for me, too. I mean, what else? How can I put it? You know what I mean? OK, I can still do things for other people because that's what I want to do. It's the passion I want to do. And one of the things about objectivism is that the government is laissez-faire. Government is the only thing the government does is enforce. The only thing the government is there for is to do things by force. Where you got to put somebody in jail, where you got to apprehend somebody, where you got to subdue somebody, you know, either police state or war. Laissez-faire, anything else. And say like charities, private charities would have to spring up. And I believe they would over time to, you know, help these people or that people. The welfare state would be slowly and possibly painfully, you know, taken up or fixed or whatever by private corporations. See, People probably, I wonder if there's some kind of profit you can get out of helping homeless people are doing, you know, that is there, how can you profitize helping people, you know, how can you help profitize healthcare, make it, well, I guess you could definitely profitize healthcare, but where's the money going to come from? But there's going to be people out there with a lot of money who will have, you know, excess money or expendable income, or what's the word, affordable, expendable income, disposable income, who were contributed to, you know, charities and to help sustain people. They say the government should not be in that. The government should not be in the welfare state. My thing is, well, also there's going to be, you know, I was thinking there's going to be big projects that a lot of people say the government has to be in charge of, or you need something really, really big to handle these projects. But nowadays there are corporations and there are organizations that can handle projects that are such big. They could probably, I wonder if they can just like drum up the revenue for it. I guess they can actually petition through elections or whatever. Not through elections, but through, you know, different processes where, say, like a big giant corporation could say, hey, we're going to put this plan together. We're going to solicit funds to do this. And we want to build a bridge across, you know, A to B and do it on the private side, you know, as opposed to doing it from the government side. It's definitely going to probably take some time for that to happen. You know, but things will eventually settle into that. You know, things will eventually settle that. You know, there's going to be some, you know, pain at the beginning. You know, make an omelet, you got to crack an egg. But to get there, I mean, I think to get where we need to be, whatever where we need to be means, to get wherever where we need to be means, we're going to have to, some things are going to hurt. It's going to hurt. And, you know, one thing objectivism says is that the fact that the government has its hand in things, doing this and doing that to help people, is actually making the whole capitalism crooked. Capitalism isn't pure, and it may or may not work when it's not pure, because the little incentives here, incentives there, people getting this, people getting that, that don't stay focused to the pure idea of your value, getting value for what you offer. And the government can skew that, where they can say, hey, we're going to give this people money, you know, maybe they don't need it. Don't, you know, maybe the demand isn't there or this over there, but the government can just make that decision and not let the market make that decision. That's what I'm saying. The government can make decisions, huge financial decisions, and not let the market make the decision in that. And I'm not sure why I went down that road, but I guess I was talking about objectivism and the whole idea of just, you know, what you want. The whole idea of what you want. Like right now I'm looking at taxes I'm gonna have to pay. And I am mad at taxes. And you know, I might be an objectivist and think laissez faire, and I may quote unquote hate taxes, whatever hate means. But I'll still pay them because I understand that's our system and I support our system. I believe in the system. You look over there, I wonder if you can see in this camera. What you see is that United States flag over there. That's what you see. See that United States flag. Can you see it in there? You can't see it now. You can see the United States flag over there. And I believe in it. I believe in this place. And I believe in this system. Actually, I probably could believe in any system. No matter what system I was in, I'd believe in it because I'm pretty sure I'd be able to make it work for me. And so, you know, that's just how I feel about that. I believe no matter what system I was in, I would be able to make it work for me. And I'd probably embrace it. No matter what. What'd you say? What if you were a slave? I mean, there are probably some extremes that where, you know, but either way, I would make it work for me. I do believe I would, you know, figure out a way to make it work for me. Anyway, I don't know, you know, where I went down this road, where I'm at right now. I'm just talking. Hey, rambling. And getting ready for the weekend. Feeling good. loving life, looking at, but see me looking around at all my laptops and my monitors and paperwork and my hard drives. And I built this, you know, I built this. And it's since I built it, it's the way I want it. Except for maybe one thing, this monitor right here that you can't see that I got blacked out. Well, you can probably see it here if I go like that. See, that white monitor, that's the only thing that I question in this place. Everything else is black. In fact, one time I bought an air fryer. It was on a hell of a price. But it was blue and I couldn't take it. I sent it back. I was like, give my money back. It was blue. I couldn't. And I didn't think I was that person. I really didn't think I was that person. Or I didn't want to be that person. See, I hit that and it didn't work. You know what? It didn't do it again. I hit it again. It didn't work. Now I hit it again. It didn't work. I'm going to hit it and hold it. Now, see, it finally changed. I wonder if it changed before. There's no way I can tell. But as soon as I pause it, as soon as I take it off of this, oops, I did that wrong. I just spliced it together. See, now what I did was I took off the remote desktop. I'm no longer remote desktop in it. The monitor is directly, the computer is directly hooked to the monitor. Oops, I just paused it. See how quick it works now. See just how quick it paused. Now watch how fast I can switch between these. Look at that. Look how fast I can switch. And now I'm not sure if I wasn't, maybe I was switching between them, you know, with the Chrome remote desktop. Maybe I was, and I just couldn't see it, but it didn't seem like I was. It really didn't seem like I was. It seemed like within a remote desktop, I can't switch this fast. And I think I really do like it working this way better anyway. And there's a way I can work this way and pretty much accomplish everything I need to accomplish as long as I have two screens. The only problem right now is I can't see the screen in my main monitor. I mean, so if I was to bring up Cubase, I wouldn't be able to see it. I wouldn't be able to see Cubase. And I wouldn't be able to, you know, do any Cubase stuff right now. I would need this screen or another screen. And in that case, I would just, you know, do remote desktop and not have this kind of response. Is it critical for me to have this kind of response? No, but I like to have this kind of, you know, I like to have that kind of power and response. Because I think that's the way it should work. And that's just the way it should work. So that's the way it should be. Just talking, feeling good. Doing what I do. Talking, feeling good, doing what I do. Okay.